This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Vladislav Lilic, a doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University. In today's episode, I have the pleasure to host Dr. Adam Mestian, Associate Professor of History at Duke University. Dr. Mestian is a prolific author who has previously published a splendid monograph on the origins of Egyptian patriotism and numerous articles in the fields of cultural, legal, and political history of the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean. In the next 45 or so minutes, we will be discussing his riveting new book, Modern Arab Kingship, Remaking the Ottoman Political Order in the Interwar Middle East, hot off the Princeton University Press. Beautifully argued and entwining multiple intellectual interests, the work contends that post-Ottoman political orders in the wider Arab world resulted from a recycling of empire. These polities, the now-forgotten kingdom of the Hejaz, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria, Mestian insists, should be understood not in terms of colonies and nation-states, but as subordinated sovereign local states, governing without sovereignty and dominated under new forms of Western oversight. Local Arab states of the 1920s and 1930s were composite legal political formations, seeking to adjust imperial Islam to a world without empire. Dr. Mestian, thank you for joining New Books Network and for taking the time to talk to me about your work.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
As is customary on the channel, I will start us off by asking how your previous intellectual trajectories had led you to write Modern Arab Kingship. How did you first become consumed with the question of how imperial regions transitioned out of the world of empires? And more specifically, you also have a background in the theory and history of art. How does your training in the arts, if at all, contribute to the analysis of recycled empire?
Well, thank you so much. This is a huge question. The idea of this book started when I was writing my first book on Egypt in the 19th century, and when I realized that book was about the making of a Muslim princely polity, which was subordinated to the Ottoman state. So I became interested, what does it mean that a polity is autonomous in the 19th century, but at the same time not sovereign in the sense of what we mean today to be a sovereign nation state? What does it mean to have a Muslim ruler who has all kinds of expectations from below and from above? And what does it mean to create a new polity in terms of what we can call imperial constitutionalism, So when people are not free actually to decide how they want to live necessarily, what kind of vocabulary we can find to describe these types of polities and situations. So this is how the book started. I was also very interested in this whole idea of monarchical politics. I myself a very anti-monarchical person, but I could not but realize that the beginning of the 20th century is full with small kings and princes and pashas and sultans. So I became interested how we can make sense of this landscape, of this monarchical landscape of the 20th century, of the early 20th century, which is very different from what we would know about the standard narrative of nation states rising and nationalism ruling, secular nationalism, and especially republican nationalism is ruling the political imagination of most peoples. And this is how perhaps my training in art theory came in, but also my other projects, which do have some art history overlaps. For instance, I have a project on Cairo's urban history, which I co-direct with Professor Mercedes Ouellet in Paris. And she's an architecture and art historian. And she was the one who, in one of her talks, in one of her earlier books, use the idea of spoliation, which is a well-known art historical operation when older parts of a building, let's say, are reused and inserted into new buildings, or not even in material terms, but also in stylistic terms, in virtual terms, an older style is reused in a new style. In a new style building and so on and so forth. Yeah, so this is how I became fascinated with this idea of reuse and spoliation and spolia in general. And I transferred this idea from the field of art history to political theory. And I thought that, well, actually, this is what may explain this landscape of monarchs in the early 20th century, that what we can see here is a kind of recycling of imperial institutions and imperial form of politics, sometimes explicitly within a new empire, like the Egypt's transition into a British subordinated monarchy in the early 20th century from an Ottoman context, or without an empire, let's say like the Kingdom of the Hejaz. So this is how the art theory became important for me, because I use certain art theory concepts in the field of political theory and political history.
Lovely. And the book is grounded in a methodology that you call global legal history. Yet, the term global here does not only reflect the work's broad spatial vista. How exactly do you wield global legal history? And do you think that your method might also find purchase in the study of other post-imperial regions the world over?
Yes, so let me answer your second question first. So indeed, I am very shameless, and the theory that I propose and the arguments that I propose, I would say would be valid also for the post-Habsburg regions, perhaps also in some Asian and African situations of new state making as well, in which I do think that this type of recycling operation works at various points of time in decolonization or after the First World War, and perhaps until today in some cases. So I try to propose something which competes with the general view that, let's say, Benedict Anderson proposed about nationalism. And I would say that, well, nationalism was very, very important, but we have this other operation this continuous recasting of empire, which is equally or perhaps even more defining state making in the 20th century. Now, back to your first question, which was about exactly what exactly? I forget it.
Global legal history as a methodology.
Yeah, sorry, it's quite early here in Taipei. So global legal history, yes. So that is a methodology that I, or a term that I proposed because the new imperial history that I have been reflecting and using and I was inspired by was not, was not enough to handle some of the issues that came out in the 1910s and 1920s when the political and the legal universe of the world is are no more defined purely by empires, but we have international bodies, prominently the League of Nations, but others as well. And so I was struggling with how to deal with the scales of inquiry between the international level, the imperial level, the local and the regional one. So I proposed that perhaps in this way we can rethink the term global and just think about the perspective of the scholar, of myself and those who are the readers who navigate between these, and actually my historical actors who navigate between these levels with these scales of politics. And so this is what I meant on global legal history. I must also say that I'm a little bit skeptical about my own terms. So I should have indicated a question mark here, perhaps, but we can discuss that later.
Mm-hmm. And the interpretive centerpiece of the book is the argument that the post-Ottoman Arab polities were neither nation states nor colonial possessions, as you've hinted already. What were they then, and what was their place in this newly overhauled international order?
Well, I mean, this is exactly the question of the historical actors. What are these news? What are these new regions? What should they be? And what does it mean to create a new polity in a moment when imperial acts of declaring new regimes are no more morally acceptable, but at the same time they are under military occupation and within almost the full power of the Allied powers? So in such a situation, when the previous type of state making is not working or cannot work because of legal and moral concerns, now what should, but at the same time, the very powerful actors, France and Britain especially, but also Italy, wanted to maintain and perpetuate their rule, then what kind of polities these are? So I designed first this idea of local to characterize the constitutional structure of these new regimes, meaning that it's not only nationalism, but also religion, and importantly, dynasty, and especially federative ideas are still circulating and legally valid in these new constitutional orders. And second, that legally speaking, they are sovereign, but they are subordinated at the same time. I know it's a huge contradiction. Usually we don't think about sovereignty as an administrative concept, but usually we think about sovereignty as a something of a moral and a absolute term. But this is how, especially in the Mandate and military occupation, sovereignty functioned in the 1920s and 1930s in these new polities. So I designed this. I use usually in the book subordinated sovereign governments or subordinated sovereign local states, because it also helps to think about how these new polities were created in some type of modular or associative way. So how federation was an important way to create either a new composite sovereign, or how actually sovereign polities were subordinated to a larger power within a federative structure.
This is a wonderful segue into my following question. You argue that monarchy and federation were two overlapping modes of reorganizing the erstwhile imperial order. What was their function in the establishment of post-Ottoman legal political communities? And would you perhaps care to offer a couple of examples to our listeners?
Yes, so in fact, I think the important thing here is to think about world history really not in a way which is the usual one, that is from empires. After empires, we see the emergence of nation states. And this dualism, either empire or nation state, defines world history. I think this is not correct. Actually, this is just simply not describes what happened. We should rather think about how in the beginning of the 20th century, the central problem of human communities was how to transform empires. And transforming empire was not necessarily through creating independent nation states, but through creating some type of federative or associative structure within the empire. Within the Ottoman context, this is very clear, that we have several competing federative ideas how to create autonomy within empire, both for the Arabs and other peoples, whether it's ethnic based on an ethnic grouping or ethno-religious identities or simply through monarchical design. That is subordinated monarchs, so the autonomy is not given to a people, but to a monarch. So there are these federative ideas in the early 20th century, which would point to a new phase of empire, a transformed, more looser, perhaps. The term they used at the time, decentralized, right? Decentralization was the key term. In Arabic, la markaziyya, or in Turkish, geyri markaziyya, and so on and so forth. So there are these ideas, and this is how we should start world history. And these ideas actually were still defining most of the 1920s, despite the immense nationalist ideology. So obviously, in 1918, when Damascus is occupied, for instance, by the Hijazi and the Allied power troops, the idea of creating a Syrian kingdom is actually the idea of a federative polity with a monarch, a monarchical federation in what is Greater Syria, so what is today Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, the state of Syria and Jordan, mostly together perhaps with the Hijaz or without it, within a larger Arab loser political empire, imperial formation. This idea, of course, could not be established because of the European allied powers and the partitions that they, the mandate system that they enforced. But even within the mandate system, we can see very clearly two, if you want, monarchical federations. Certainly, one is monarchical, one that is the so-called Sharifian solution. That is Iraq, Jordan, and the Hejaz forming one connected chain of polities All of them are ruled by the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, the Ashraf. And they are composing in a way a blood-related monarchical federation, a genealogical empire, as I call it. And in the French Mandate, which is properly speaking Lebanon and Syria, in the beginning we can also see a federation. This is the so-called, it is the so-called Fédération des États Syriens between 1921 and 1925, which is a federation of five small governments, the state of the Alawites, the state of Aleppo, the state of Damascus, the state of the Jebel Druze, and the state of Lebanon. Sometimes Lebanon is out of this federation, sometimes we're in it. So there are, and this federation is both an answer to the previous Ottoman visions of decentralized polities, and also a tool of the French mandate authorities to divide, if you want, the population. It's a very interesting moment, the early 1920s, when we have all these federative polities in this region. So these are the concrete examples.
Wonderful. And so stimulating. I mean, in my own context, the context which I study, modern Balkan history, federation emerges as a potential vehicle of recycling or transforming the empire as early as the 1860s. And this resonates so strongly with some of these earlier aspects of shared Ottoman history, albeit peripheral, but still quite Ottoman. My next question has to do with religion, though. You also show quite forcefully that religion played a constitutive role in the successive attempts to recast the repertoires of imperial rule across the region in the 1920s and into the 1930s. What were some of the ways in which Islam helped the grounding of local states in their constitutional orders?
that's a big question. Thank you. Well, I must say it's not only Islam, but also Christianity. And Zionism as well later. So religion is all around in the interwar period, just as much as nationalism. In my context, first of all, it is very clear that the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, led by the famous Emir of Mecca, Sharif al-Hussein, their plan is to create a new caliphate. The Sharif al-Hussein actually, finally in 1924, it's often forgotten, but he declares himself to be the new caliph after the Ottoman caliphate is gone. So this new, if you want, genealogical empire that they wanted to create, an empire of led by the Ashraf as kings and emirs, was to be a caliphate, a new caliphate in which al-Hussein would have been the caliph and was the caliph for a short time. That is a use of religion, and they used immensely their, of course, potential and, if you want, spiritual capital as descendants of the Prophet Muhammad in this time, both in Jordan, in the Hijaz, of course, the two sacred cities especially were important for them, and, of course, in Iraq as well. That was an argument for accepting Sharif Faisal, who was the second son of al-Hussein and became the king of Iraq, although he never been in Iraq before that moment. That was one of the arguments that the post-Ottoman military men, and with the active support of the British authorities, made that these Ashraf are descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, so they can be accepted both by the Shia and the Sunni populations in these regions, and they are Muslim monarchs, so they will be also good for the Christians and Jews and many others, more religious groups. One must say that this argument, so the use of religion in state-making, was, of course, also a European, if you want, almost essentialist or racist tool to create new states. Famously, for instance, in Egypt, the British authorities thought that, well, the Islam is so strong that they cannot handle it directly, so they need a monarch who can talk to the ulama, and through the ulama, the monarch together can create stability and use religion to oppose any kind of riots or revolts against the continued British rule. So there was that use of religion as well. But the local actors themselves also wanted to keep Islam and Christianity and other religions as part of constitutional orders, meaning that they wanted to create laws or constitutional texts in which religion is explicitly acknowledged in one way or another as a legitimate part of life. And of course, with these, especially for Muslims, the continuity of the Ottoman Sharia courts remained until the 1950s, well, in some cases until today, in these polities. So it's in the mid-1920s when this becomes really explicit. And this is because the two main counterexamples are Republican Turkey, Atatürk, who, of course, completely abolishes or tries to completely abolish the Sharia courts and other religious institutions, and declares complete secular polity, and of course the Soviet Union, which also declares its opposition to include religion in political and legal life. So this is a moment in the mid-1920s when many of these post-Ottoman Arab advocates and activists realize that these are bad examples. And so they explicitly start to advocate, in some cases, for instance, in Syria, for a monarchical solution, because they believe that monarchs will be the ones who will keep the principles of Sharia, for instance, alive, and the Sharia courts alive, and so on and so forth.
We are in the mid-20s again, 100 years later, and the question of the use of religion in state-making seems to still be wide open in and beyond the region that you study. Do you see the book as pointing to some lessons, pitfalls, and advantages of the use of religion in statehood and statecraft? And are there any parallels that we are seeing with what's happening today?
Yes, thank you. This is a beautifully posed question and very timely. Yes. I do think, this is a history book, so I'm not a political scientist and I'm not proposing solutions to problems in a direct sense. But what I suggest is, first of all, to think about world history in the last 100 years, not only through nationalism or the norms of democracy and the nation state, but also through religion. And if we think about, indeed, in the last 100 years at large, how religion functioned in terms of state making, then we can see that it never disappeared. It was always with us. And even today, some of the nationalist regimes who declare themselves to be extreme nationalists, for instance, Viktor Orban in Hungary or General Sisi in Egypt, they are all using elements of religious propaganda or actually they create new constitutional regimes in which religion and religious principles are again part of the legal order. Meaning that very likely it's not very likely, we already noticed that the project of secularism failed, if it ever was in a winning position. Perhaps 1960s, 1970s is the only time, 1950s to 1970s, the only time when we can talk about a secular constitutional political wave. For American listeners, of course, this shouldn't be a surprise, since the American Constitution is a very religion-friendly constitution, actually, right? So this is something that we have to deal with: how to think about religion, indeed, as part of constitutional orders. And today we have these challenges, for instance, from Afghanistan to Hamas and many other polities, which claim certain religious ideas, religious principles to be part of a political imagination, and not only political imagination, but of a legal constitutional order, and what to do with it. Our normative structure, our international normative structure, it appears, cannot deal with these claims. Right? So the United Nations, for instance, at large, or political science, is, these institutions and bodies of thought, they cannot deal with religion simply because they were not established. They are based on the norm of a secular nation state, and that's it.
Changing gears just a bit, the book also sheds light on local agency that made and remade post-imperial political orders. Would you perhaps offer a few examples of how ordinary people navigated complex legal landscapes inherited from a collapsed or a collapsing empire? For instance, I really enjoyed chapter 6, where you detail how the bifurcated Ottoman legal system, encompassing both state and non-state or Islamic law, continued to frame social realities ground in greater Syria. So this can also be construed as, what was the fate of Sharia in this geopolitical reality?
I didn't get the first half of your question because there was a... Can you repeat, please?
Yes, just wondering about a few examples of how ordinary people navigated this complex legal landscape that was inherited from a collapsing empire.
Yeah, so how ordinary people, we have, of course, there is a legal chaos, first of all, in the late 1910s and early 1920s. This is really a moment when people don't know to whom they belong. There are multiple claims on their belonging, and there are multiple claims about whose legal system one is belonging to, and according to whose law that the problems should be adjudicated. What we can see in the Sharia court records of Damascus is that people very, very quickly, just immediately after the occupation, wanted to restart litigations and went to the Sharia court very, very a lot, really, from dealing with the everyday things, especially female litigants. Why? Because the Sharia court, of course, was the main, in Ottoman times, was the main, in modern Ottoman times, was the main place where to go with family law issues, and especially about child care, financial nafaka, the child care maintenance issues. That is one of the main tasks of the qadi at this time, to register and educate child care claims, and especially in a moment when many males are in the army, and perhaps they died, or they are captured, or certainly they are not around to help the family. Still, in 1918, 1919, childcare is a central problem, a central everyday problem in these cities. So I actually am right now, I'm writing a little article separately analyzing this issue. And these female litigants were very much attached to the Sharia court. They could not, I mean, at the time, actually, the so-called Nizamiya courts, which became later, the Syrians started to call them simply hukuk, so legal courts, were not functioning yet. And anyway, so it's a complex problem. But the Sharia courts were the main forums to litigate these everyday concerns. And then when the slowly the first Nizamiya courts continued in this new secular forms called hukuk, and then the French established a new court system later on in the 1920s, 1930s, but it was still the recycled form of the Ottoman courts. So there are the legal landscape, especially in this micro level, is very interesting. And of course, we have the large population movements, right? The forced displacements of peoples who suddenly became the subjects of new polities and have to learn even new languages, for instance, to understand the new government. So the legal landscape is very interesting, but at the same time, I must also say that not everything is new. There are these continuities. People are many are attached to old legal forms, partly because their properties are in these old legal forms, and they want them to continue, and they want to adjudicate according to the old law. Also, people are taking advantage of this moment of legal chaos, right? This is the moment when property records are supposedly disappearing and then reappearing, and then the new cadastre is being made in many of these states, so a new survey of land records. So there is a large, giant reorganization of the property regime in many of these new states. But still, as I said, based on very often until the Ottoman principles, for instance, in Syria and in Egypt, until a very, very long, many, many years, still 19th century notions, legal notions define litigations about, of course, Awqaf and many other property forms. The Nizamiya law, the Nizamiya courts, which apply the Majella, the Ottoman code, are still there throughout the 1920s. Actually, as we know very well, some parts of the Majella until today recognized in some of these states. So this is a very long, very slow process to transform the legal landscape. And we have to be really pay attention to these forms, I think, until the 1950s at least.
Thank you for the exhaustive response. Finally, you conclude with an interesting discussion of chronology. So how does the age of recycling empire square with the conventional 20th century chronologies that dominate our Western scholarship? So when did the recycled empire end in the Middle East, and are its legacies still shaping the geopolitics of the region?
I would rather think about, as I said, about recycling empire as an operation which happens in many situations. It's not not necessarily a political age. But we can, of course, define that by the 1940s, especially 1948, when Israel is born and the new Arab states are defeated. And most of these new Arab states are, although they are still in some form of subordination to France or Britain, but more or less sovereign. So by that time, this operation ends. And certainly in the 1950s, when there's a revolutionary wave, the last vestiges of empire are swept away. At least this would be a convenient way to think about it. But of course, if we start, if we open our eyes to a larger context, we can see that, for instance, Libya, actually a post-Ottoman North African region, when it becomes independent, there is a Libyan kingdom which exists until the late 1960s. So what we can see there is a perfect example of recycling empire and continuing much older institutions in a new form, of course. It's not the same, but it's a new form. So for instance, in that case, recycling empire ends much, much later than in other regions. Perhaps in some regions, it never ends. So this would be my answer. I think for Eastern Europe is an interesting case. It's really the Soviet umbrella that ends. And paradoxically, real nation states are made in the Soviet umbrella. I think the Soviets are the only ones who actually take the nation state very seriously.
But one can argue that Eastern Europeans of today are still trying to grapple with the rubble of empire. Look at places from Kosovo and Moldova through Ukraine and Afghanistan. The imperial legacies are still very much there, and ordinary people are forced to navigate them, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, there is the legacies are there. But there is also a new type of, so there are new processes ongoing, which are, we can call them imperial projects. They are not the old empires, but they are operating with the same type of logics or similar logics than the old empires. Just they call themselves in a different way. So, Yeah, it's very much everywhere. Yeah.
Last but not least, where has this project taken you, Dr. Mastian? What are you currently working on?
So I have a number of different projects right now, but one is that I'm very interested in the economic dimension, and I think new imperial history in general lacks the economic dimension. So one way, what I'm doing is I go back to the 19th century, one project, and I try to understand this almost a microhistorical project of 19th century Egypt as a princely state. What did it mean in fiscal terms, and to see the fiscal administration of Egypt between the 1800s and the 1880s. So this is one project, and the other project I go to the up in the 20th century, and I look at the land survey in the state of Syria between the 1920s and the 1950s, and I look at the land survey office at the cadastre in a very very detailed way, and think about how, for instance, the federal structure of this Etat Syrien influenced the cadastre. What did it mean to create a federalized land survey, and so on and so forth. So, and I also have a distant project on environmental history of Cairo. That's a different trajectory. And finally, actually, I have a plan in the future to write a history of Syria and Egypt, the the story of the United Arab Republic in the late 1950s, early 1960s, as a federative project without empire.
I, for one, cannot wait to see what comes next out of your workshop. Dr. Mestian, it has been a real joy having you on the show. Thank you for coming on and Happy New Year.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you very much.